On the evening of January 6, 1972, Professor Peter Bomer returned from a basketball game to find his Ocean Beach home surrounded by police cars with their lights flashing. Because his place was a known commune for leftists and anti-war activists in the area, he thought better of announcing his arrival, instead finding a safe place to call in to find out what happened. He was dumbstruck by the news. A drive-by vehicle had fired shots at the house. One bullet had entered in through a window and struck a woman inside named Paula Tharp. She would forever lose much of the function in her arm. For 6 months, San Diego PD failed to follow up on any leads, and the assailants remained at large. Then, in June of 1972, someone bombed the Guild Theater, which was known for showing porno movies. Thankfully, no one was injured, but because a district attorney and a police detective were in the audience, a massive investigation was triggered that would connect these two events to a right-wing extremist group known as the Secret Army Organization. Welcome to episode 3 of Extrajudicial, where we'll explore a wild case of dysfunctional anti-communist counterinsurgency in Southern California.
Thanks to everyone tuning in for this episode, because we are honored to have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Peter Bomer. We've been really looking forward to this conversation, so in order to optimize our time with Dr. Bomer, we're just going to briefly set the stage with some background and context about the Secret Army Organization. We recommend visiting our Substack to read the fuller story, which we'll publish in the next couple of days. It's a must-read for anyone interested in intelligence operations like Gladio, COINTELPRO, MH Chaos, and the like.
The theater bombing and the shooting in Ocean Beach would both end up being tied to this group known as the Secret Army Organization, which had been formed in 1971 by several members of another recently defunct group known as the Minutemen. Now, there have actually been a number of versions of the Minutemen in American political culture, but this one was an anti-communist militia formed in 1961 to prepare for the day when Americans would fight in the streets for their lives and their liberty. Real Red Dawn stuff. Minutemen cells sprang up around the nation, planning and staging attacks on leftists and clashing with law enforcement throughout the 1960s.
In February of 1971, a group of six Minutemen leaders from four different states met in Yuma, Arizona, to formulate a new approach that would skirt what they saw as pro-communist elements inside the Justice Department. The newly dubbed Secret Army Organization was much smaller than the Minutemen, perhaps never numbering over 200 nationwide, but their goals were fairly the same. Membership documents communicated their ideology and plans, including combat teams, weapons, and equipment training lessons, intelligence work, and security as they entered what they called Stage 2, a time for assassination and counter-assassination, terror and counter-terror.
In San Diego, the group began regular flyering about local liberals, radicals, and anti-war activists. Names on the mailing list included a naval commander, a county supervisor, a vice admiral, a Marine Corps brigadier general, a rear admiral, and San Diego police officers. But by late 1971, had set their sights on San Diego State College professor Peter Bomer, with whom they had undoubtedly become familiar due to his controversial firing and rehiring after two students complained about their grades. In November, they issued a special bulletin that would provide SAO members with a complete physical description of this so-called red scum, along with his home address, phone number, vehicle description, and plates, as well as the names, addresses, and vehicle descriptions of four close associates. SAO members were encouraged to pay them all a visit and say hello.
So before we continue, we need to welcome our guests who can share the rest of what happened much better than we can. Dr. Bomer, thank you so much for being here with us this evening.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
So, Dr. Bomer, or can I call you Peter?
Good, I prefer that.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, Peter, there's obviously so much to say, and you've undoubtedly told this story more times than I know you care to remember. But before we get into the night of January 6, 1972, could you give us some background on how you got to San Diego and what the political climate was like at the time? Some of our listeners may be younger and might be surprised at the extent of the anti-war movement's influence and impact.
Okay, let me go back briefly to my history. I'm the son of Holocaust survivors. I grew up in New York City, and my parents had really values of equality, justice, all people the same, treating people with dignity. But they felt very powerless to change, and they suffered a lot. They did survive the Nazis, but, you know, barely. Growing up in New York, and then I went to college on a math scholarship at MIT in the 60s. And, you know, I was quite liberal. I was supportive of the civil rights movement. I became increasingly against the Vietnam War, but I thought the United States was a country that was a few protest letters to the editor, the one Vietnam would end, and there'd be more racial equality. As the 60s proceeded, I became more and more critical of the United States and Vietnam. I saw it wasn't like a mistake, but in the systematic part of U.S. policy trying to dominate other societies. I was in grad school in economics at MIT. I switched from math to economics, and I applied for a job in San Diego State, and I was very interested in going to San Diego. I had many friends from there, and it seemed both the border, wanting to learn more about Mexico and seeing the border was very important, and also knowing there were a large number of GIs, a lot of base in San Diego. And by this time, it's 1970 when I applied for the job, more and more people in the military were against the war. And it wasn't true. I was very much part of the anti-war movement. You know, the whole thing of we spit on GIs was mainly made up. I thought trying to work with GIs to turn them more against the war was part of why I went to San Diego. So I moved to San Diego in August of 1970, and the anti-war movement had come later to San Diego than many other cities, but there'd been a lot of protests in May 70 after the United States invasion of Cambodia and the killings of students at Kent State and Jackson State. So there was a growing movement there, but also a very conservative city, very strong, both the military basis, a lot of weapons, military-industrial complex, some really corrupt developers, so that it was a much more conservative city than it is today. But there was also a real openness to this anti-war movement, both within the military and outside the military.
So was your impression of San Diego obviously not as radical, but you saw the anti-war movement was growing here?
It was a force. There was an openness to, you know, from the very beginning of moving to San Diego, you know, I was pretty outspoken about the war, and I lived in different places, but I know by January of 71, I'd moved to Ocean Beach, and I remember organizing protests. In fact, my first arrest in San Diego was we'd organized a protest both against the war and against some developers. It was before mass gentrification, but it was an attempt to turn a park into some fancy apartment building. So I remember we had a protest that connected those two in winter of 71.
Okay. Yeah, and we'll be referring to years and dates a lot in this interview. But and just one thing to touch on there, too. So San Diego State College hires you. They may not know about your anti-war activism, but they know about what approach you take to economics, or, you know, you're hired by them. They must look at your CV and know who they're hiring, right? Like, that's fair to establish.
There was an openness at that time. There were a few other faculty. There was one specific, Clint Jenks, who was in this great movie, Salt the Earth, who had been a labor organizer, went back to college and got a PhD, kind of a mentor of mine. So there wasn't an anti-communist, anti-leftist view. There was an openness to that. Maybe they didn't realize how much of an activist I was, and I'd been in an elite school at MIT, which was considered the best economics department. But yeah, I didn't try to hide my views when I applied for the job and I got it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I think that's important to touch on. And so you started San Diego State, and you were really put through the ringer there. Do you want to walk us through what happened there and what might have led to undeserved attention off campus?
So I taught a lot of principal economics. I taught comparative systems, some labor economics, and, you know, I did well. In fact, my second year there was a vote by students. I was voted the best faculty member there. But by my second year, 71, 72, a long time ago, there was a growing attempt to fire me. They found two students who said I had graded them badly because they were concerned, you know, had students grade themselves. And it turned out one of the students, basically, who was very right wing from Reagan's office, had been pressured to fire me. And I think also from the FBI, according to a secretary in the president's office. So I went through three hearings. And, you know, I was charged with stuff like I gave preference to women and students of color being my class. But I pointed out my class was still about 40% white male. So there were a lot of charges about what I was teaching that I didn't follow the syllabus or the, like, comparative system. I taught about China and Cuba, but they said, you know, those countries didn't, they weren't all terms to capitalism in the 40s. So anyway, I had all these charges. And major hearings, there were protests every day, some with hundreds or even a few thousand people. I had 6,000 students sign a petition, which was 20% of the campus or more. I got cleared of all the charges, but it did make a lot of, like, local, even national news. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the year, when school ended, I got fired by Dumke. He was the chancellor, even though I had three sets of hearings, one by the American Association of University Professors. Each of them had ruled in my favor, and my class were very popular, but I still lost a job at the end of my June of 72. And one last thing on that. Yeah. The American Economic Association is a pretty, very mainstream group. I think they were the first, I was maybe the first case that they said it was political discrimination. The union supported me, and it did go to the state Supreme Court, but the state Supreme Court did not overrule it. Partly they said there were a lot of demonstrations. They argued some of my behavior in demonstrations was why they didn't overturn the ruling. Mm. So that's a very quick summary.
So we went through your archive at San Diego State.
Okay.
And the amount of support you had, you know, between the students and people were really backing you up, but it really did seem like they were going to railroad you.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it seems I did try. I had a lot of support. The economics department, except for one person who's close to Reagan, did support me strongly. The union supported me and represented me. I remember Chicano Studies and a lot of the departments supported me. And there were some rallies, you know. It was a pretty active period. Like, I remember one at the Aztec Bowl, it was well over 1,000 people who came to show support. So there was a lot of support, you know, by the students and faculty and staff also. Mm-hmm. But in this city of San Diego, it was much more mixed.
Yeah. And like we saw a lot of news articles, the Daily Aztec, and we were sitting there going through the files, and it was like, you know, there was a lot of attention on you in the press, and it made me think, in a way, all this publicity put you on the radar of some more nefarious individuals that we're about to talk about a little bit more. But did you ever feel like that was the direct result of the harassment?
I think it's so the first I got arrested my first year. I don't think I was that well known for a demonstration in Ocean Beach I mentioned against development. And it was an undercover agent who made a lot of false stuff. Like I said, I had guns behind the picture of Chairman Mao. I didn't have a picture of Chairman Gout, no guns. And I remember a visitor, he was also arrested. All the charges got dropped, but that happened to me very often. And I remember one of the police chiefs, I don't think it was Hubler, but a leader said, "We have somebody in every one of Peter Bowman's classes, you know, police." So I don't know if that was true, but it was said. So there was even early, and this is before the publicity, and I remember this probably was an early secret army organization. In, I believe, April of 71, I had been asked to speak at a demonstration against the Vietnam War, UCSD, you know, one of the main campuses besides San Diego State, La Jolla. And while I was there, there was a call to the house I was living in Ocean Beach, you know, saying, I don't know, you know, they knew they were watching me. They were kill me or attack me. And that was very early. That was the first year before the publicity, before any of the charges. So some of the stuff did begin earlier.
Okay, so May 71. Okay. Do you feel you were targeted more as an anti-war activist or more for publicly Marxist views as an economics professor or both?
Okay, so I did think about this question, Trevor, and it's a good one. I even showed it to my daughter last night. I have four kids, all of whom have, you know, pretty really good values and have been to San Diego a lot. So I think basically that I was a kind of an activist, but also as a teacher, they saw me as particularly dangerous. To, you know, I've tried to very much develop people, not force my views on anybody, but I think very much this kind of top-down view of social change, right? Because there's so much, you know, hierarchy in terms of the way the systems run, in terms of corporations, the government.
Right.
So I was trying, but so I think that they saw me as subverting the youth of San Diego, you know, somebody coming from the East Coast, moving out there. And it is true, in all my teaching, I've been very influenced by social movements. You know, what are some issues being raised, whether it's, you know, economics, political economy, which is a related field, which I teach a lot that combines economics, politics, history, is pretty critical of capitalism. Talking about social movements, I think seeing that I was really involved in activism and a teacher, I think that combination, and I'm not sure which one is more primary in terms of it. I guess one other thing I'd like to add is I think the repression against me can't be understood, and they will get this outside of the Republican Convention in, I believe, the spring of 71. You know, Nixon talking about, who's president, talking about San Diego being his favorite city and saying the Republican Convention was going to be in San Diego in, I believe, it was August of 72. And so much of the infiltration, I haven't really talked about all of the undercover agents I've had to deal with, I think is very much tied to Nixon and the Republican Convention plan. And I was not the leader, but I was very active in organizing protests against the convention, which actually moved in the end because of our organizing to Miami, but it had been planned to be in San Diego.
Okay. So, yeah, convention for the audience, that'll come up again. But
I wanted to add that one of the things that I came across in the collection at San Diego State was a letter from, an executive at National Steel and Shipbuilding. And they were responding to a solicitation for financial donation. And the response was essentially, you know, they were not going to be donating money to SDSU because of professors like you. And he literally says, I would not permit a child of mine to take a course from him. And
okay.
I'll send you a picture.
I didn't know that. Thank you.
I'll send you a picture of it.
I didn't know that.
But I think this is just such a poignant example of something that still goes on today in academia as far as, you know, university decision-making and priorities being set by donors. And a lot of people's livelihoods were, you know, destroyed in the 60s because of what possible repercussions that would have for the, you know, university's fundraising activities. But yeah, that's just kind of an additional thing that I suspect was in play here.
I'm really happy you said that, Anna, because my feeling is, I don't know if we'll get to it, that today the situation is even worse in terms of donors and the federal government putting pressures on the university to basically, you know, propaganda machines to justify economic inequality and capitalism. And in my case, I didn't mention this earlier. After my first hearing had to do with basically the class thing I mentioned, I gave preference, you know, in grades, which wasn't true. I had students grade themselves and other things. And I got cleared of all those. Then there was a second set of hearings had to do with protests I had been in. And the AAUP heard them, and I got cleared of those. The president, Ed Walker, even though he'd originally signed on attempting to fire me, he did rehire me temporarily. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned that. But then the Chancellor Dumke, who was very close to Reagan, who was all the state all the state universities had a third set of hearings, and I cleared those also, but then I got fired. So it came from higher up. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, Reagan had been a propagandist for General Electric before, and I do think the corporate, you know, wanted to have economics just be a kind of pro-business, not be critical of inequality, mm-hmm. and, you know, how workers are treated was very much part of, you know, what was going on.
Definitely. I mean, the university is a neoliberal business, as we all like to say now. So,
definitely.
So is there anything else we want to cover before we move on to the non-SDSU story?
Okay, one thing I'll mention, SDSU, because this is confusing to people. So when they began to be the attempt to fire me, people formed a committee that I was part of. I think it was called Committee to Stop the San Diego State Railroad. You may have come across that in the Aztec. So that really got to do with the railroad, the thing I later went to prison for. It had to do that I was being railroaded, and a pretty large movement developed around, I mentioned, the 6,000 petitions. I just want to add, and I had been involved the first year in forming a student group, you know, very much student-led, against the Vietnam War, against ROTC, which we felt was university complicity with the war, and also about San Diego State being more welcoming to particularly Chicano and Black students.
It's really wild how far we supposedly have come since then.
I know. Right. I know for sure. I think I had a naive view that there was all this progress and it would continue. Not necessarily, I never thought, oh, we're going to have this utopian socialist society in my lifetime. But I did think some of the development would grow. And I know when the Roe versus Wade decision was overturned by Supreme Court, it was shocking to me because I just thought the whole issue of abortion was something about the right for women to choose had been decided on. And I realized victories, we always have to keep struggling if we're going to advance toward any kind of justice and liberation.
Indeed. And I think what's so important about your story and stories like this in general is that young people today, you know, they think that the things that they're participating in terms of activism and movements are unprecedented. But then you look back and it turns out that they're very precedented. And it's, you know, it's not to be doom and gloom about it, but I think it really gives you a sense of what the stakes are and why, you know, the establishment goes to such great efforts to prevent change.
No, I totally agree. And you know, one of the things in terms of my whole life, going back to the 60s and 70s, even up to today, is I've also always tried to be involved in building multi-generational movements. I think, you know, people who are older, that if we don't think we know it all, we can share experiences. And younger people have usually the energy, willing to take more risks. So to me, the idea of sharing lessons, building multi-generational movements, which is very hard in the United States, particularly among white people who often don't know people of different ages. But anyway, that's been a kind of motivating factor to try to build things out of, for the reasons that you kind of gave, sharing those experiences.
I mean, it's a very noble quest. I think even just being in our 40s, we've experienced kind of some ageism and alienation, you know, working with younger groups. So, I mean, but we all obviously have the same goals. So it's just there's so much to be learned, especially from people like you who have already been through it. So.
And I'm still at it, but I do appreciate what you said. And I know what I wasn't saying was easy, by the way. I think it's very, very difficult to do the thing across the generations, different culture, you know, cultural music. But anyway, it's something I've always been committed to. And even though I mentioned Clint Jenks, who was really an amazing guy at San Diego State, you know, he was older. He had been blackballed from labor organizing in the 40s, but was not elitist at all and really shared his knowledge. So just like I'm trying to do that today. I really recommend the movie he plays himself. It's one of my favorite movies called Salt of the Earth. Salt of the Earth.
Okay. Yeah.
It was, and when I lived in San Diego, I showed it many times to different audiences, like working class audience. I remember in San Ysidro one night, and I would have Clint speak after it too. So I really recommend the movie. It really shows kind of race, class, gender, the importance of dealing with all of them in building movements.
How cool that you got him to speak in your classes.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. I love that movie.
And also, by the way, he represented me. He also represented me to some of the hearings when they were trying to fire me. I could have one representative, and I picked Clint because he had been such a fighter. So I picked him to represent me.
He was a union rep?
No, he was professor of labor economics at San Diego State. And he had been a labor organizer of the mine mill and smelter workers in the mines in earlier, but he went back, he got a bachelor's degree, a PhD at Berkeley, and then got a job at San Diego State. And I was very close to him, but I would have in my hearings when I try to find me, you could have, besides myself, you would have one representative. So I picked him.
I see.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize there was a San Diego connection to Salt of the Earth. So now I need to rewatch
very much.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. So, things obviously got a lot crazier. Well, maybe from our perspective, things seemed like they got crazier, but I don't know about, I don't want to, you know, put words in your mouth.
Right.
So leading up to the shooting at your home, we know you were being harassed. We know that the Secret Army Organization had also wrecked the offices of the San Diego Street Journal. We know there were cars that were firebombed, including one in front of your house. At one point, there was a rather lazy effort to kill Chicago 8 defendant Jerry Rubin while he was in town. But is there anything else that happened before the shooting, leading up to the shooting, that you feel like wasn't given enough attention by law enforcement or in the media?
Okay. Well, Jerry Rubin, I remember he came to San Diego State with us. He also spoke at one of the rallies for me at San Diego State.
Oh, okay.
There was that connection too. And, you know, I had, remember my cars, I had very often, like, even in 71, spring of 71, like, I'd often come out, I'd speaking at either my class or maybe a student group, and come out, and I always have two of my tires slashed. That was really, really common. And I had tear gas put in my car also. So there were a fair amount of incidents. And, you know, many, you know, calls. I never actually got them myself. My roommates would get them. I lived often in collectives. You know, we all would be active and we'd work in different groups and discuss it and try to develop good personal relations among each other too, but there were also calls threatening me or other people. And the flyer you mentioned about looking up Peter Bomer, we did receive a copy of it in late 71. Mm. So there were a fair number of incidents before. I believe before the shooting, because the threats, I never particularly liked guns, but I did ask for a permit for a concealed weapon for the police, and they turned me down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they turned you down?
Oh.
I didn't know that.
I got one who's honest. After the shooting, I did get a permit, but before the shooting, they had said no.
Okay, so the night of January 6th, you were not at the house when the shooting occurred. Can you tell us more about how it unfolded from your perspective? I know in the past you mentioned a basketball game.
Yeah, so I was friends with most of the players, especially the black players on the team. I remember shortly before the shooting, they were in a tournament in Hawaii, and they were saying they were dealing with a lot of kind of anti-black racism and what to do. So, I mean, I didn't have many ideas. So they, I think Jeff Pete, he was the captain of the team. He gave me like really good tickets for the game. And I was with another economics professor named John Hardesty, who was a leftist professor at San Diego State also. So after the game, we drove by and we saw all these police cars. And so I went to a phone booth and I called. They said, oh, you know, Paula Tharp had been shot in the elbow. And I came back. There were a lot of police there. We actually, because of our distrust of the police, there was so much infiltration. I get to that. We want to talk about later in groups I worked with that, you know, I wouldn't have called the police. People did call them and they were there. And we later found out, I think it was put by one of the people in the Red Squad, Pearson. They had put a bug in our phone that somebody found. And later on, there were even this claims, I believe, by the police. It could have been the sheriffs were saying that maybe I had done the shooting to get, you know, publicity.
Oh my gosh.
But, you know, I'd been, you know, I was pretty well known at this time in San Diego, and there were about 10,000 people at the sports arena of the game. It wasn't at San Diego State because it was a very Long Beach State, which was the big rival at the time. So, and right after the shooting, we said it's probably, you know, the Secret Army organization because of all the threats we had received. The day of the shooting, there had been friends of us down the street who were doing organizing in the military a block away, and they got a call saying, you know, say goodbye to your friends down the street. This was the afternoon of the 6th. And also either that day or the day before, there were all sorts of kind of threats on my door at my office at San Diego State. So there was a lot of stuff going on at that time.
Yeah, the Secret Army guys would have stickers, and they would put the stickers
up. Yeah, that's right. They had stickers on my door, and I think there were words too. But I remember the stickers on the door at the university. It didn't go inside, but it was on the door.
That reminds me. So what I was saying, we were looking in your papers, and we saw San Diego State's response to you immediately following the shooting for heightened security measures, and they said they changed your locks on your office door. And that they started recording your phone at work. Does that any of that ring
okay? I remember my office mate, who was pretty conservative. And I didn't mind. He asked to move to a different office, so I did have my own office. We professors at that time shared offices, so I do remember that happened. Mm. I didn't know about the phone until you said it. But some of the stuff you both told me is more than I knew until we spoke forever, too.
Yeah, I had not looked at your papers yet when we last spoke, so that was very edifying. Now, it seemed like the San Diego left, and you said the different collectives, the anti-war activists, and the police had a very tense relationship. Are there things you can share from your experience that, you know, would kind of let the audience know a little bit more about, like, what kind of atmosphere we're talking about?
Okay, so this was an example before I got there, but it was indicative. During May 70, there was a sit-in at San Diego State, and this one person said, let me get everybody's name in case there's an arrest. And it turned out he was a San Diego cop. I think his name was John Paul Murray. And people found him out because he was supposedly a member of the Democratic Military, which was an anti-war group within the military. And he once was visiting his wife in the hospital, and then people saw his different name. And so that's how people figured out he was a cop. But then by the time it came out in a few hours, the police called and said, if anything happens to him, we're going to kill 10 of you. That was, you know, one example. And it often was the police and the FBI working together. There's another person named Wayne McCracken who, I'm getting ahead a little bit, he was involved in the anti-war movement, the convention coalition I mentioned. And then when I was on trial, we formed the defense committee, but he had a wire to two police outside and, recorded all our meeting, which was illegal. We tried to later have my conviction overturned, but we didn't win. And, he told us, he took LSD and told his girlfriend he was working for the police and FBI. And she called me. She called me right away. And then he actually, most people hate him on the left because he'd given up so many names. Like, he was told at each meeting, you just had to get sign-up sheets to pass the names on. And then each person he was asked in meeting with the FBI and the police, who was a military threat to the government, who was a political threat. And I was seen as a political threat, but not military. You know, he was told to waste money at our meetings and to waste time. But people do that anyway. But, you know, there were so many examples of infiltration and, lack of trust, and surveillance. And so, there was a very bad relationship between the police and also the sheriffs, San Diego County sheriffs. I could give many other examples, too. Those are just two that came to mind.
Two good ones.
The paranoia must have been just nerve-wracking.
So,
And just let me add one thing to the paranoia thing, because this is, I think, a lesson today. So there's so many other people I can name, but I also am very concerned of what I call snitch jacketing. Mm. Like, later a group I worked in, this was later on in San Diego, called Center for Radical Education, and there was one person, who had very big difference politically. Like, they were kind of orthodox, like supporting Stalin, all this. So I got calls saying this person, Jim, I won't give his last name, works for the police and he gets paid money at this corner. And so I remember once with a friend following him and then later getting through the ACLU a lot of my FBI files, which I have, it's clear to me he was not an informant, an agent, but they were trying to further divisions. So I think even if a group is totally legal, so many groups I've worked in just education groups, and they still infiltrate. So they're not just provocateurs, people are informants. But to me, for most groups, I think even the bigger problem is just people suspecting people, or even, the government enforced trying to get us to suspect people. And to me, that can destroy people's lives, too. So I guess I'm saying it's really bad to be infiltrated. And, we have to take steps against that. But it's as bad, to call somebody an informant or agent who isn't.
You don't do that lightly.
Exactly.
It still goes on today. Definitely aware of.
Especially on social media.
Exactly. Even worse. Yeah.
Yeah. So going back to the police's response and the relationship with the police and the left, so in the archives at San Diego State, there is a letter from San Diego Chief of Police Hubler responding to a campus Senate inquiry into the status of the investigation. And he states in that letter that they have already expended some, quote, 300 man hours in efforts to bring about its solution. And it's funny because this letter is dated January 17th, 11 days after the shooting.
Right.
Did the police ever follow up directly with you at all?
No, they never did. And so after the shooting, I helped form a group called CIRT, Committee to Investigate Right-Wing Terrorism. And we had meetings, we wrote statements, including saying to the police, I never met with them personally, but saying that we thought it was a secret army organization who had been involved in the shooting and other threats. And there seemed to be no interest in it at all.
Mm. I guess after...
Until much late.
Yeah, after we talk about, the rest of the story, I guess it'll make sense why. But just a real quick follow-up. What was the context for the campus Senate inquiring into the status of the investigation? Did you go to the Senate about it?
Well, okay. So I may have. The union, it was called the UPC, United Professors of California, did support me strongly. and so did the economics department. So I believe I think the UPC, I remember there's a guy named Wally Koppelman, who was a leader of the union, they did go, I believe, to the Senate and other places too. So I think that was the context.
Okay. Yeah, there's a different union for the faculty at SDSU now. So I'm just kind of curious what the dynamic was back then.
I think it was AFT. It was called UPC. It was all the state universities, I think, but I'm not 100% sure. It was tied nationally to the AFT.
I see.
Yeah, I just want to say that letter from Hubler, where he puts in writing, he says some 300 man hours in 11 days, and it's just that's got to be a lie. He's just like,
well, that's not even 24 hours a day.
Right.
It's
right.
And yeah,
the math ain't math.
It kind of just gets me. Sorry.
Yeah.
So I came across an article from the Harvard Crimson from 1975, where a writer described the local police not only as cooperating enthusiastically, but with right wing, infiltrating groups, but also directly connected the Secret Army organization with the FBI's COINTEL program. Have you been able to determine the extent of the relationship between the police department and the Secret Army organization?
You know, my knowledge is probably similar to what you've seen in documents. I can get into when I did talk when I was in prison to one of the Secret Army organization members, William Yakupek, but we can get to that. I always suspected, because I said, because of the convention coalition. And then there was somebody, I remember who, a person who I found out was an informant named Gil Romero. I remember he was trying to get me and a guy from the Brown Berets to go to Tijuana. He said, all these beautiful women there, and I had no interest in going. And it came out, right, he was an informant. He did admit it. And Gil Romero, he tried to implicate me in some other stuff too. But then also, I'm trying to remember, I think this was somebody who worked at a bank, and I think it was Segretti talking about kidnapping me and Tom Hayden. During the convention, before the convention, having us in Mexico and letting us go afterwards. But in both cases, the first case with Romero too in Tijuana, it came out there were going to be a lot of guns there, and very easily would have been killed, even though that wasn't directly said. So there was a lot of, police. And again, I guess it's police, and probably the most clearly is the FBI, because the main person in the SAO who all the information about this from that, I call it a wanted poster. It basically came from FBI files, things I hadn't told. And Howard Barry Godfrey, who, to me, he was the main person in the SAO, even though officially he was not the leader, but he seemed to be involved in so many of the dirty tricks of the SAO, was directly on the payroll of the FBI and under a guy named Christensen, who did lose his job eventually, who was one of the FBI agents in San Diego.
Yeah, and there's a lot more of that for us to get into here in just a sec. And we especially, nowadays we need to explain who Donald Segretti is to our listeners.
Of course.
Watergate is something I think the younger generation doesn't know a lot about, in spite of how big of a scandal it was back then. But just jumping back real quick, because you mentioned that you talked to Yakupek. So in 1973, you did some time in prison for your involvement in blockading the Santa Fe Railroad line in Del Mar, which was used to ship war materials to Camp Pendleton. And you met some members of the SAO while locked up. That was Yakupek and someone else. And let me just jog my memory. Yakupek was convicted of bombing the Guild Theater, correct?
That is correct.
Right.
Okay.
And Hoover was the one who was so the night of the shooting, again, I'm not sure which of the two did the shooting. the claim by Godfrey, who was the FBI informant who came forward when the SAO people got arrested, he claimed he was driving the car and Hoover did the shooting.
Okay.
Hoover said, so Hoover was the guy at Chino with me, and Yakupec was, he was convicted on the theater, but also, at least what he told me, he said these people were following him, and he was told by Godfrey, who was with his wife when these indictments came down, that he was told by Godfrey that these people were following him with friends of mine, so he kept ramming their cars, and I believe he got convicted of them and assaulting the police officers also.
Ah.
And one correction, as far as I know with the train, you know, I was at a faculty meeting at San Diego State, and it was just, I decided to develop relations. I went up to Del Mar. It was during the United States bombing of the Haiphong Harbor, increased bombing in Vietnam, so a lot of protests. So I went there, but my understanding was the train was going from L.A. with war supplies to San Diego and then to Vietnam. So, I mean, it was going south. So I don't know. It wasn't going, as far as I know, to Pendleton. It was stopped a quarter of a mile from the demonstration, so nobody got hurt. People set some. There was a meeting, and I chaired the meeting because when I came, there was UCSD students. Most of them I didn't know. Said, "Oh, you're very well known. There were always helicopters ahead. Why didn't you chair this meeting?" At the end of the meeting didn't say do anything. People placed these railroad ties on fire, and then the sheriffs really started beating people. I hid and got back to San Diego eventually, because Del Mar, just here north of where I live. And eventually, there was a call for a grand jury investigation because the mayor got beat up in Del Mar by the sheriffs. And I got arrested on aiding and abetting, not saying I did it, but saying I had helped plan it.
Wow.
And all the people who testified against us had been undercover sheriffs, most of whom had infiltrated, one or two of them I knew, who had infiltrated kind of the door, which was a alternative newspaper, other places. And then after the convention moved, they surfaced and four of them testified against me. That was, all the evidence against me was from these four sheriffs, undercover sheriffs, who surfaced during the trial.
So there was someone with the San Diego door that was a informant or a, like,
he was an ex-sheriff. I think his name, Jim Marmack, if I remember correctly,
who
worked on the door.
Okay.
But was also an undercover sheriff.
Wow. That was a left-wing. Was that a local left-wing newspaper?
Yeah. The Street Journal, which you mentioned earlier, was an outstanding muckraking paper. But basically, they dealt with a lot of repression. And they had pretty much folded by fall of 70, or maybe even a little bit earlier. I moved in, I said August of 70. And then the door was the main paper. There was also the Ocean Beach Rag. Those were the two main kind of left papers. There was also the Reader, but that was, you know, less leftist.
That leads me to this question, that it was in the San Diego door. And for the audience, you know, we're going to have a supporting post explaining more of this, but so there was Secret Army Organization member Jerry Bush, who wrote a letter to the San Diego door in 73. Now, do you recall the first time you saw that? And, like, what did you make of those claims? Like, did that kind of bring together a bigger picture for you? Or you had already kind of suspected these things? I'm just kind of curious your perspective when that happened, because that was a big bombshell.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not sure, you know, we're talking a long time ago, I'm trying to remember as well as I can, you know, there was stuff that Yakupec, who was the other prisoner, we both worked in the prison as fingerprinters at Chino Institute for Men. So I did talk to him some there. And I guess, you know, while I was in trial for the Del Mar thing, next door, Hoover and Yakupec were in trial, and I did go in. So even though the government prevented, they used national security, so they prevented a lot of the testimony from Godfrey or some of the others. But I was very familiar by then of the kind of FBI, SAO, San Diego, you know, police or sheriffs, that there was connections. So it wasn't, it was not, and I think Bush was actually a leader in the SAO. I'm trying to remember the names of some of the people, but I remember, I did know his name at the time. I mean, even before his letter, I meant.
Oh, okay. And the back to the prison, you had mentioned that, so Yak Peck was the bomber of the Guild Theater, and then there was Hoover, who was allegedly the shooter of the night of January 6th. You and Yak Peck, more or less, I mean, you worked together, and Hoover, you had a different kind of a feeling from, that he was, I remember you telling me he was a bit, he was not approachable.
Well, he was a white supremacist, and, you know, in prisons both then and now, I do a lot of prison support work now. You know, prisons are very divided, black, Latino, white. It was, when I was at Chino, I was there. When I got convicted, it was 90-day observation, meaning you went to Chino for 90 days, and then at the end you came back to court. So I was only there for that 90 days at Chino. And so Hoover was very much tied to the white supremacists, so we definitely avoided each other. And I was basically, I think I was mainly close to Chicano and black prisoners. There was somebody from the Black Panthers who, he and I, we said right away, we'd both defend each other. Because, you know, at that time, you know, any fight meant knives, you know, and I wasn't, you know, wasn't my background. I get along with people well, but I didn't come from like a street background at all. And so with Yak Peck, it was really strange. I remember toward the beginning, well, they put me in solitary first in prison. I'll go a little more. And they kind of, the warden kind of threatened my life when I got out of solitary after there's a lot of support for me. He basically said, if you do any organizing in here, you'll never get out. So it was kind of a death threat indirectly. Then when I got there, the sheriffs had written a really negative thing about me, about organizing. So they almost sent me to Tracy, which was the other receiving place for prisoners. But in the end, they just put me in solitary in Palm Hall. There were four solitaries in the state. So when I got out, if you had a job in prison, you had your own cell. Otherwise, it was two to cell. So they offered me a job, you know, fingerprinting. And they wanted to be the head of the fingerprints, but I said no. And then Yak Peck was there. And even before I talked to him, one of the prisoners said, oh, he had grabbed the Playboy out of their hands. And you never do that in prison, right? And this guy said to me, do you want me to kill him for you? I said, definitely not, right? So, and then with Yak Peck, we just sort of glared at each other for a few days. Then I said to him, you know, we can either just try to get along minimally or we can fight, you know. And I was hoping he would say get along. So we didn't. I mean, he was really isolated in the prison. I know when he left to go to another prison, he gave me his comb and mirror, you know, which is a big thing at that time in Chino. Yeah. So then he just told me how he'd been set up by Godfrey, you know, who thought he was a good friend. I mentioned the thing with ramming cars. Yeah. And he told me, and I don't know how much it's come out, like, yeah, just about how they were watching us. Like, we used to do sometimes target practice in El Cajon. He said they thought of killing us. And he said how, yeah, some of the people from Watergate, I'm trying to remember who besides Segretti, he mentioned other people also, and I'm not remembering who they were, but at least one or two of the very well-known names from the Watergate hearings. So he did, yeah, just told me how they were used a lot. And so that was some more of my knowledge that, you know, of the SAO at that time.
Wow, not like Gordon Liddy or Howard Hunt.
No, it wasn't those two. But it was somebody else. I mean, yeah, it's so far back. And I don't know if everything he told me was true, by the way, but he did mention other people also, and that there was, you know, quite a bit of discussion about, you know, attacking people on the left from the, you know, Committee to Re-elect the President. It was called CREEP, was called.
Yeah, so
perfect name.
We can segue to that.
Right.
Point of clarity, so Yak Peck did say Segretti was at the ranch?
No, okay. To be clear, okay. He said to me, that Segretti met with people in the SAL. To be, I don't remember if he said at the ranch or not. He just said there were meetings between them. Okay.
So oh,
just
to okay. Be, yeah, but clear. Still, if the, I mean, the,
right.
The meeting definitely. Is the, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
That's Jerry Bush and Yakupec both stating, you know, I've tried to like track this, triangulate it, et cetera. And, you know, you said Yakupec was isolated in prison. I know between him and Jerry Bush and others, there was a lot of anger over finding out this whole project had been, you know, Godfrey was an informant and they felt like they'd all been sent up the river sort of thing where he got off scot-free.
Right. Exactly.
I don't have a point there, but just...
yeah, that came over. Oh, I mean, I didn't talk to him that much. I weren't like we're friends at all.
Right.
But yeah, that how he'd been used, I think I mentioned earlier, I'll repeat it, yeah, that they were watching. He was watching with Yakupec's wife. He thought Godfrey was the best friend. And then the grand jury, whatever, they hear, came forward and saying about Yakupec and Hoover being indicted, and it probably said in the testimony of Godfrey, I don't remember that for sure, but he did say that, you know, he just felt so betrayed, so, you know, somebody with his family at the time of the indictment.
Yeah, betrayal. That reminds me, there was the I don't have his name in front of me, but he was an El Cajon gas station attendant, and he thought that Christensen, the FBI agent Christensen, had deliberately sent him on a trip to some right-wing convention or something, and he had planted stuff in the gas station to make him look more involved in the secret army than he really was. So all this stuff, no honor among thieves, I guess I would say. But
right, and Christensen did lose his job, but nothing else happened because he held on to the gun, and so and then didn't come forward with it, which is the crime too. But he just lost his job; nothing else happened. You know, one more thing I want to add, Trevor, is. And I've never really pursued this, is that poster that was used, you know, I got a copy of them. There were hundreds of copies, I think, circulated. Judy Barry, do you know her name? She was very active in Earth First and was trying to unite. Yeah. She was trying to unite loggers and environmentalists in Northern California through the IWW and Earth First. And shortly after that, a bomb was placed in the car and she was injured. She died later from cancer. I'm not sure if it was tied to the bombing or not. But again, similar to in my case, where, you know, they said maybe I had done it to get publicity. She also was a suspect in it. But one of her lawyers said there was a poster put on her and some of the language was word for word the same as in mine.
Oh, man.
And they thought maybe, I think it's held, you have to check, I think, but you held the head of the FBI in Los Angeles. Yeah. They thought it was very involved. It was a father and a son. I believe the name was held, but I'm not 100%
sure.
I think
you're right.
You could check. Yeah. That, so they thought that may have been the connection. And the San Diego FBI and the LA FBI seemed very, very connected.
Yeah. And, that'll get me to, we'll talk about Lewis Tackwood, but first I wanted to get into the creep intrigue with Segretti a little more, just to lay it out for folks. Now, multiple people in the run-up to pre-Watergate had placed him in San Diego. Then we get the San Diego Door article from Jerry Bush saying, you know, Godfrey and Segretti, posing as Don Sims, visited the Gunsmoke Ranch. You know, so I reached out to Donald Segretti to ask him about this stuff. And so I emailed him and I just said, oh, do you have any recollection? Would you want to speak about this? It can be off the record. I mean, I told him I'm a librarian. I'm not a journalist. And I did not expect to get a response. I really just thought, hey, he's still alive. He's in Orange County. Why not reach out to him? And the next day I got a phone call and I'm like, I look at the area code and I'm like, it's Donald Segretti. Like, and I'm at work. I answer the phone and he acted like very confused. And he's like, you had some questions for me about, did I know a Howard Godfrey at the Gunsmoke Ranch? And I was like, yeah. And he vehemently denied knowing Howard Godfrey Christensen. He said, this was funny. He said, I've never been to a Gunsmoke Ranch. I don't hang out at ranches. And the only army I've ever served in is the U.S. Army. I think he said he said he had never heard of any of this. And I was like, well, that's a long time ago. But why did he call me back?
Exactly.
You know, that felt very like my stomach kind of sinking. Like, you know, why would you call me, who's a Joe Schmo? And yeah, I asked you something from years ago, but he made very clear that he did not know about any of this.
Right. Protesting maybe a little bit. Right. Protesting too much. So yes. There's one other connection, which I remember seeing at one time. And it was somebody who worked at U.S. Bank, I believe, in 72, where it was in the, I think it was in the Union, but it couldn't be the L.A. Times, where Segretti, again, using Sims, somehow they knew it was Segretti, talked about the thing I mentioned earlier, the person who worked at the bank, about kidnapping me and Tom Hayden, right, who was living in L.A. at the time, and taking us to Mexico. So that's another connection, Segretti. I don't know if you've come across that or not.
No, I have, and I don't have his name in front of me because I know I've seen the name.
Yeah. I think it's Phillips was the name of the person who I didn't know.
We'll definitely put that in the write-up. And that's where, I mean, the other thing I wanted to mention with Segretti that intrigued me, there was a New York Times article about him when Watergate stuff started coming out, and then his name was mentioned with the Vermont shenanigans and things like that. And it said that he had been in U.S. Army intelligence, you know, and that kind of set off some alarms for me as far as...
Right.
There's a picture of him from the early 60s. He has like a buzz cut. He looks very conservative. And then this New York Times article, I'll send it to you, says, oh, Donald Segretti, he has a, who's the Black Panther that, oh, Huey Newton. He has a Huey Newton poster up in his barracks, and that he's all about, he's more liberal than the other soldiers. And I'm like, you know, knowing what we know now, and
right.
He comes out of Army intelligence. And
right.
we don't know the full story of Watergate and what he was up to even before Watergate. But, you know, there's just a lot of things that don't make sense. I don't have a, like, smoking gun, so to speak, to, like, you know, point anything at. But circumstantially, it's all really damning.
Well, he also got hired because of his rat-fucking expertise, so...
Absolutely, but it seems right. like there was a lot more than just that rat fucking stuff that he ended up, I think he was only charged with misdemeanors for and did like a month or something of time. But
yeah.
I mean, it starts turning into speculation, and, you know, we want to try to avoid that,
yeah.
but it's worth
just, yeah, there's probably a lot we'll never know, right?
Yeah. Okay, now we move on to what we know about, I mean, we can put this in the write-up, but the
right.
Lewis Tackwood corroborating a lot of what Godfrey confessed to and what Jerry Bush divulged. And for listeners, in October of 71, this police informant named Lewis Tackwood holds a press conference, and he indicates that the Criminal Conspiracy Squad, aka the Red Squad, and the FBI had organized Squad 19 to provoke violence at the 1972 Republican National Convention in San Diego, and that would be in turn blamed on leftists. And the object of it to create a situation which would permit the president to invoke special emergency powers, leading to the arrest and detention of political activists throughout the country.
Hmm.
Did any of the Lewis Tackwood stuff fall on your radar back then that kind of illuminated anything?
Okay, we were familiar with that. And we did speculate, but there was no in terms of that we're aware of him. And again, I know, for example, some of this came out later, but even then, you know, I went to L.A. once. There was a protest about by firing at Gumpke, who was chancellor of the colleges. And I remember there was all this stuff that came up. Some came out later about us being followed. Even I know somebody's house who very well-known person in L.A. today about the family. And they were checking all their plates and who they were. And, you know, so we were way of Tackwood, and I think his name did come up in the convention coalition, but it was nothing very concrete about specifically disrupting in the convention the way you talked about.
Okay.
I guess with a but with the convention, I want to add is we did really have a good organizer. You know, we were planning both like a people's fair that we would connect like to the Vietnamese in Vietnam and have like events every day, like a People's World Fair and nonviolent direct action to kind of disrupt the convention, you know, because of the war. That was the main issue, but other issues of the Nixon administration. And it came, so they claimed it was moved to Miami because of some budget problems, but from some of the books of Magruder and some of the other people close to Nixon, it was totally because of organizing. They expected, you know, that we would have a lot of people there. John Lennon, you know, had come out in favor of the protest there and talking about leading people there. And the thing I wanted to share on this, I think when protests have victories, they never will give credit to the protest. They will say it's some other reason. But so often in my life I've had where, you know, we did organizing and we do have victories. You know, I wish we had more. There are victories, but we're never given credit for them by those in power. So people shouldn't get, you know, too discouraged because we're not given credit. So that was an example where the convention moved because of organizing, which in some ways is different from, you know, trying to call martial law. But, you know, again, there may have been different trends within the Nixon administration, and both of those may have been thought about.
Yeah, no, and I want to underscore, too, probably how much work was being done by folks like yourself trying to, like, you know, make an impact at the convention that year, that they were scared, that, obviously, you know, they were pulling out all the stops. You know, what's so interesting with the Tackwood thing is you said before the L.A. and the San Diego FBI, you know, being rather close. And that's really interesting to me in light of, like, you know, well, here's this guy. No one's quite sure, you know, if we should trust what Tackwood says. But he's giving the broad strokes of all this violence and mayhem that Howard Godfrey is blabbing all over the place to people in the fall of 71.
Right. No, for sure. I thought of that.
It's wild. At the end of the day, it's like, you're right. When organizers win, sometimes, you know, they won't give us the win, right? Because that would strategically
encourage more.
Yeah.
Right.
Now we can, there's a lot more. We can keep going as far as details in that, but I was going to bring up the ACLU case. Now this comes, how long were you in prison? I'm sorry, how long did you serve?
90 days, basically.
Okay.
Including jail.
All right. So, you did 90 days in 73, and then basically it's kind of like what happened after that as far as, you approached the ACLU, they approached you, you know, what was being done at this point, or what were you pursuing? I know.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, two things. I remember when I was in prison and I got out, people had to, you know, I had to have a job, and I couldn't get hired. Often I'd go to places and the FBI would say, you're hiring this guy. He's an organizer, socialist, communist. So I wouldn't get jobs. But some people from San Diego State, they set a place called Center for Radical Education. And I did work there for a few years. We did and we were infiltrated too by undercover people too. And we were an educational group. We had events every Friday night near the San Diego State campus. And Yeah, and this one guy named John Rasper, I think it was in the Washington Post, you know, he had said how the FBI had encouraged him to kill me, but they wouldn't give him, you know, an excuse. They wouldn't give him an alibi, so he didn't do it. And so I'm saying all sorts of things. We're just totally an educational group, you know, a pretty effective one, but that's all we did. But so that was the one thing I did in San Diego for a while after I got out. And then about a week after I got out of prison, I was staying at a friend's house. And I got arrested on the police broke into the house in the morning in Ocean Beach. I actually wasn't living in Ocean Beach. I just got out of prison. And I got arrested for felon in possession of a weapon. And I got violated for it. I didn't go back to prison. But then I guess two things that are relevant. One, they gave me as a condition, I think I wrote you this, they gave me as a condition either getting a PhD or going back to prison. I had a 1 to 5 year sentence hanging over me. And eventually they were going to violate me. And I went back, and that's how I got my degree, my PhD. I was ABD. I was all but doctorate the first time I taught at San Diego State. And I think they really wanted me to get out of San Diego because I got off probation way before I finished my PhD. But then at this hearing, this ties to the ACLU, at the hearing, the lawyer who represented me was a guy named Petey Young, who he had been the lawyer for Anthony Russo, who had been the co-lawyer. He'd been the co-defendant with Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg, who Lenny Wineglass represented. Oh. And then he offered to help me, to defend me, because we had the defense committee infiltrated. And there was also another police cartel, I think, who had written that I have not been that active in Del Mar. It's called exculpatory evidence, and they haven't given it to us, but we found that out. But anyway, Petey Young represented me, and I didn't go back to prison, which was good. But then he was affiliated with ACLU, and then the ACLU offered to do the case. It was originally for me and Paula Tharp, the woman who got shot, but then two other people, Sherry Whitehead and George Katsirfikas, both of whom I've lived with and were very active in the movements too. It was all four of us was the case.
I saw their names on the SAO flyer.
Right, right, exactly. And we even lived in the same room because it's a very small house with 11 people. And I certainly couldn't do that today. So the ACLU, a guy, I think named Mark Rosenbaum, he was the head of the ACLU in L.A. They decided to take the case. So I said, sure. The problem was they only put up $10,000 to do the whole case. And they hired Petey Young to be the main lawyer, the one who had represented me for some of the Del Mar stuff, the appeal and so on. And it just was an overwhelming case. And I think it was maybe too big. And I've always had trouble like really raising money for something around me. So I didn't really raise money for it. And Petey Young missed one or two deadlines and the case got thrown out. I think we had a strong case. It went all the way up to Nixon and, you know, Kissinger, probably too many people. And, you know, they were hinting to Petey Young that they would, if we didn't pursue it, they'd give us money, because I knew they knew there was, you know, a lot of wrong behavior by the FBI and the government. But that's what happened with it. So it didn't get all that far. And I think it was really a well-written document, which I know you have a copy of.
Yes. I was going to say, you know, I'm not a legal expert or anything, but, when I first started it, I'm like, oh, here we go. It's got Peter Bomer, Paula Tharp versus Nixon, John Mitchell, Harry Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, John Dean. But by the end, I could see what they were going for and, you know, why they laid it out like that. I mean, maybe that tactically that wasn't the maneuver to do at that point.
Right.
But if this is all kind of post-Watergate, I see them through Discovery wanting to make this into more? Because it's this Operation Inlet, which for the audience, it's basically like a COINTELPRO sub-project, but really coming down the pipe from Nixon, where they wanted to kind of lay out that, and you know, Christensen and Godfrey talked every day, they said, in the documents and in the, later in the testimony. And it's like, where was it going up the chain from there? Because obviously Christensen's not the cutoff. The cutoff's much higher. So I see what the ACO guys wanted to do, and it just feels like, oh, such a big what if like it could have moved forward. So, yeah, I mean, I get how it's broad, but.
Yeah, that was the idea. I think Petey Young, who deserves a lot of credit, he wrote most of it. I know there were quite a few names of lawyers, but just I want to recount one thing. During this hearing, it was called the writ of habeas corpus, we try to have the convictions overturned for me and the person named Peter Mahoney for the police misconduct during, you know, the Del Mar trial. And I remember one night, Peter was staying at our house, you know, working on these various lawsuits. And we heard this noise outside my house. We went outside, and these cops pulled guns on both of us. And I'm pretty relaxed in the situation that I had guns pulled on me very often in San Diego by the San Diego police. And I just had to be very relaxed because I thought, you know, they might shoot by mistake. And Peter was so nervous, Peter Young, and I kept saying, calm down. And I remember afterwards, nothing happened. It was clearly just harassment. We were being harassed a lot during this hearing because we subpoenaed a lot of the Red Squad, the undercover agents who were like following us a lot. Mm-hmm. And I remember afterwards, he called the Times saying, oh, San Diego police pulled guns at us. He couldn't believe, you know, this Harvard trained, you know, very well-known lawyer that would happen. I think he never fully recovered, but he drank a lot that night. Oh, and so he was the one, you know, who really was a major role in writing up that case. And he was a brilliant writer. But so that's the document. But he did miss, I said, some deadlines of subpoenas he had given us, some of the names you mentioned that he hadn't maybe followed through on. Mm.
And they just needed an excuse to shut it down. So it's like one definitely missed deadline.
I believe it was a Nixon-appointed lawyer. Maybe it could have been filed again, but it wasn't, right? So it was also, I mean, excuse me, a Nixon-appointed judge who was the one who threw it out, which I thought, you know, he should have recused himself.
For SAO and intrigue like that, I mean, anything else you would like to add? But I just want folks to know that I know that you moved on to bigger and better things in your life. You know, hardly this episode defines you. You've been an activist, from what I can tell, in all kinds of ways, you know, from the late 70s after this episode all the way to, you know, the present day. So, you know, whatever you'd like folks to know.
Thank you. I appreciate a lot. Your words mean a lot to me. I guess what I want to say is I think in my life in San Diego, I had problems that are very connected both directly and indirectly to both Nixon, who was president, or Reagan, who was the governor of California. But I feel the current government today, the Trump administration, you know, the Stephen Millers, the Russell Vaughts, I feel were more in a danger of fascism, was total authoritarianism than any time in my life, even though, you know, between Nixon and Reagan are both, you know, total criminals, and I have no respect for them whatsoever. But I think the current administration is even more dangerous. And so it just seems we need so many levels of protest to stop it, and just thinking it's going to go away. It's not, unless we really, you know, build. And again, I think college, I don't know who listens to the show, but I would think college students have played such an important role in the United States and other places in working for justice and against reaction and, you know, racism, injustice. And so I really hope that the resistance is up to the task, and not only try to maintain the status quo, because the status quo brought us you know, Trump and Vance, et cetera. I think we need to go beyond it, you know, both the defense protects some of the liberties and some of the positive things, but also with a vision, you know, which I call participatory socialism, going beyond the existing society today. And I guess one other thing, I feel I was victim of a lot of COINTELPRO, and COINTELPRO stopped, but I don't know if you're familiar with the people who are listening to NPSM7. It's a document, it's kind of COINTELPATRIOT Act on steroids, asking to investigate using the Internal Revenue Service, the FBI, other agencies to investigate people who are against capitalism, against traditional family values, using Antifa, which doesn't even exist in organization, you know, basically, how can you not be anti-fascist? Anybody who's anti-fascist is saying, you know, under threat now. So I do think we're in a period of possibility, but also a very, very dangerous period. And I'm still as active. I'm still very active. I stopped teaching 3 years ago, but I'm still teaching, just not for money. And, you know, and I appreciate the chance to talk on the show with you.
Well, yeah. We appreciate having you. And yeah, for the audience, NPSM7, that's the Pam Bondi just mentioned the other day that they're going to come out with a list of names of people or
right.
Allegedly.
It apparently has been leaked. Oh. I haven't looked at it yet, but that's what's been in the news today, actually. You mentioned, you know, Antifa being non-organizational. There's really no limit to what can be said about, you know, movements and groups in order to malign them. And, you know, this is a scary time to be openly left in American history.
Right.
And this isn't the first time that it was scary to be openly left, but it is a time.
Yeah, the McCarthy period, even right after World War One, when 2,000 people were basically deported, you know, against World War One. And I want to add, too, in terms of universities, this, you know, I said I'm of a Jewish background, and the whole kind of weaponizing of anti-Semitism by these right-wingers have been so anti-Semitic to try to undermine the Palestine Solidarity Movement. My main activism over the last 2 years has been against, I call it the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And I think there are many issues. To me, that's one really important issue. And it's so upsetting to me the way they're using anti-Semitism, which is real, but it's so much more associated with the right to try to undermine student movements, the whole Palestinian movement, try and deport people who, you know, are sympathetic to, you know, the Palestinian people in this genocide. I mean, you look at the pictures of Gaza, you know, what's happened to kids there, and, you know, it still enrages me. And, you know, so that's something I've been very involved in, and I think is still a very, very important issue. And
yeah, it's
Trump and Biden. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
For sure. And it's really ironic because, and actually this is the next episode that we're working on, but, you know, during the first Red Scare, the threat of Judeo-Bolshevism or a Jewish communist conspiracy was used to deport a ton of Jews. So,
right.
Like,
I know.
And that stuff is still very present. Yeah. I see comments on social media about Jewish communists all the time. And it's really crazy how long this conspiracy theory has endured. And I'm like really excited to tie it to what's going on today.
Well, it's so important to do that.
Those events are there for us to learn from, but for some reason, you know, sometimes we don't.
Yeah. I guess one last thing I was thinking, Anna and Trevor, is, you know, one reason I'm sometimes hesitant to talk about what we've been talking about, I agree with you, it's really important, but sometimes I'm afraid that people use repression and, you know, the infiltrations we hardly talked about to justify doing nothing. I think it's really important we're aware of this history of repression, of false propaganda against people who are just basically working for, you know, a just society. But people can use it to do nothing, you know, to hide under the covers, and then the people in power win. So I think it's important to learn, but it's a way to strengthen us and seeing the importance of fighting back and going beyond, like I said, the status quo, and not using it to justify, you know, doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I point completely taken there. We do need to, you know, stay very diligent about what's going on and making sure that no one gets too
right.
Just throwing their hands up and assuming that nothing can be done. But at the same time, it is a literal what is to be done kind of question.
Definitely. No, and I think often there's a danger, and I see it, and I've stayed active. I think certain people just have this activist motor in us. And, you know, I feel like I can look myself better in the mirror by trying. I never know really what's going to happen. But I think there really is a danger of our private lives taking over. And of course, it's important that we find joy in life, that we not just be depressed all the time. And finding joy is really important. But I think we also do have a responsibility to go beyond just our private lives.
Mm-hmm.
Well said.
Yeah, well said.
I guess, yeah, I see it all. I mean, not to be brainy about it, but it's kind of like a dialectic where sometimes I worry about, you know, where our podcast is about, you know, putatively parapolitics and the connections of the powers that be and things like that. And if that, it can be very discouraging, but at the same time, it's like it can be energizing trying to understand, yeah, like the anti-war stuff that you did in the early 70s, you know, had them going to great lengths to stop you and others, you mm-hmm. know, that it
right.
So that has power, I think. And that's why we wanted to let more people know about this story. You know, it's when I first came across it, it was in a Mae Brussel book, and she mentions the San Diego Secret Army Organization. I'm like, wait, what's that? You know, I've never heard of this.
Right.
I've never heard of this. So like, never had I come across anything until this past year where it was all of a sudden like, this is just, there's not a single book on it. There's some articles on the web, which, by the way, I was going to bring up to you. A guy posted something a few weeks ago. I'll send you the link, but it's Jeffrey Kay's Substack. He's did a big, really good job doing the story that I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I'll email you.
Okay, but, great. Okay, to be continued. I'm looking forward to the podcast.
Well,
yeah,
we're so grateful to you for speaking.
Yeah, okay, thank you for your time, Peter.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Solidarity.
Same.
Solidarity. Thanks, everyone, for joining us with Peter Bomer. You've been listening to Extrajudicial.